I
can introduce Chloe. So I met Chloe at an ECG conference in New York. She works in private equity, and she's currently the CEO of a global sports fan group. In addition to, she's a proper deal maker, and I wanted her to meet everyone in the group. Just she can add a lot of value. She also runs the Republican Party Business Asian Caucus. She does a lot. So.
Okay. That's an interesting caucus.
Yeah.
Again, if you're new, I would say we're bipartisan, we're sort of nonpartisan, really. We are here to talk about issues where we have common ground on philanthropy, or you know, no, we're not here to advocate. We could be somewhat political, but not too political. I haven't seen Brian. Good. Since you haven't been around, or Ryan, I guess Ryan, you did introduce yourself. Alex, you spoke. Alex Zhuk spoke at one of our conferences. I don't think I've seen him lately. But again, Spencer, or I guess Thomas, and anybody. Again, just this is sort of open mic time.
Hey, Mark, it's Brian Waldner. It's been a while since I've been on. Let's see. I am head of EP Wealth's ultra high net worth and family office investment offering, and work largely with colleagues in the private markets. So I'm here to help if anybody needs help or networking. But I always get a lot of value out of connecting with folks on this network. Thank you, Mark.
Sure. Thank you, Brian. Thomas, you want to say hi?
Yeah, sure. Hey, Mark. I'm fairly new to the group, but looking around the gallery and looking at the speakers on this panel for Opal, I'm connected to many, many folks here. I recently joined a very large asset management firm last September, big ETF firm, Dimensional Fund Advisors. They've never had a dedicated family office group. So I joined, built out a team, and we are bringing, their very, easy to understand ETF portfolios as a ballast to family office allocators that are really focused historically on alternative assets. And I came out of, private equity and venture capital.
So are you coming? You going to join us in Newport?
I'm coming late to Newport. My flight lands. I'm trying to change my flight after listening to you speak. So my flight lands in the early afternoon. But I plan to join you guys at some point during the day on Sunday.
I could always tell my story about a guy in Singapore, Mark Shmulevich, who changed his plans. He says, it was 11 o'clock in this evening. He said, I have to take a 9 a.m. flight to make it. And he made it. So it's a lot easier maybe for you to switch your flight. But if you could, that'd be great. But
what I may do is I may drive up on Saturday and just cancel my son. Because I'm, believe it or not, I'm flying from New Jersey only because I have a
multi- where in New Jersey?
Bergen County. I'm in the northeast.
All right, right. I'm coming from Short Hills, I'm going to drive past you at 6 a.m. other new people, Karen, we got to meet you in San Francisco, I guess Palo Alto or Menlo Park. You want to introduce yourself?
Thank you. Hi, I'm Karen Landry, and I had the pleasure of attending both the San Francisco evening event followed by the Palo Alto event, and I have to say, both thumbs up. It was outstanding, Mark, and I want to really thank you and Erica for inviting me. And we're going to be on the phone tomorrow for a few minutes.
Pretty good.
Thank you very much.
And hi, Spencer, just saw you. And Stephen Burke, Thomas mentioned ETFs. Do you want to give a quick shout out on what you're doing with ETFs?
Yeah, we just launched one using our flagship separate account strategy that has a 25-year GIPS verified track record, has outperformed the market by over 200 basis points gross, and has an alpha of over 250 for the 25-year period, and we're doing quite well. We launched the ETF. It's a 30-stock portfolio. We launched it on the 26th of June, and it's under the symbol AFOS, AFOS, and available for investing now.
But there's also a special
question? Excuse me. Can I ask a question? Is it equally weighted? Is it equally weighted, Stephen?
Oh, it's stocks we pick. It uses our 25-year track record of our SMA portfolio. And it's really a high conviction, so it's overweight energy, industrials, materials, out of five sectors or four sectors now.
But Stephen, I thought one of the special sauces is what you're doing with the 531.
Yeah, that's only available at launch, Mark. So when we do the next one, which will be in October, you can convert low-cost basis stock into the ETF and defer your taxes and diversify your holdings. So
take note of that, Greg Wilder. You're probably familiar with the 531s. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else before we turn?
I'll say hi.
Yep. Go.
Vicky Van Balen. I was blessed to be included in the Bellevue and Seattle event. Thank you very much. Known Walter, and I've been working with Walter recently, and Keith, and my background is technology and, you know, some angel investing, and I'm really excited to have met this group, and like Karen, I say two thumbs up on the events that I've been to so far. So, thanks for including
me. Well, it's great to meet you too. Anyone else new? Anita, you're sort of new. I'm just going to give time for new people.
Hi, Mark. Nice to be here. I'm a learning specialist and hoping to share about Kinder, the organization I just founded.
Look forward to seeing you in Newport. Sure.
Thank you, Mark.
And I see Evan, if you want to again introduce yourselves, or Carl.
I'm Evan. I am an analyst for the CS Family Office, and I am just here to see what's up. Pleasure to be here.
That's fair. Here to see what's up. So you'll find out. Carl, you want
to? Carl Bradley Family Foundation, and just chiming in per the invite.
Yes. So this is, we're about to merge into the briefing. And we've met Carl in Seattle, and a lot of people in Seattle, I learned, sort of go to Europe for 4 or 5 weeks. I'm not sure about you, but a lot of the Seattle crowd sort of tuned out for, I'll be back after summer. It seems like that's the best time to be in Seattle is right now.
But it is. Well, normally, Mark, it's raining in June until about July the 5th.
Yeah.
This year we've actually had a special month, but yes, you're right. Most people go away in June.
As we came. Anyone else new before we move on? We have more people. I have to go to the next. I can only get 50 people on a screen here. Dave Reese. Been a while.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Where are you at these days?
You know, Manhattan in the office, but good to be tuned in. My name is Dave Reese. I raise capital for independent sponsor transactions. So groups spinning out of like Carlyle and Tri-Atlantic, and also invest. We've made 9 private equity investments as an LP over the last 12 months.
Beautiful. I see Carl Pro and. I'm headed tomorrow to Pittsburgh to see Carl Pro. They luckily discovered, and I heard the story best in Riyadh when he explained it, that they saw this rubber, the tire, melting naturally or the given some catalyst, and they've now patented that. And the world has way too many tires that are being buried. And he's going to, or being burnt, so he has a way of a better paralysis. Anyone else new? I see a Marina Schwabek. or Albin Scaria. Again, this is sort of open mic, welcome to the community time. Scott? Bryson?
Morning.
Scott here. Yeah. I'm making breakfast. It's Canada Day in Canada, so I'm making Happy pancakes Canada for the family.
Day. Nice.
Great to be here. Thanks very much, Mark, for having us or having me. And yeah.
Excellent.
I'm from with Impactful Capital. Sorry. My head's in pancake mode.
All good. Anyone else?
Hey, Mark, Jack Wyatt here. I believe that it's Canada Day in America, as well as the nation to which he just referenced, and that we should all celebrate our neighbors to the north. And your travel to Pittsburgh, you know, reminds us that 361 is on wheels. And I happen to be driving to your third favorite state right now.
Third favorite. Okay. Which is that?
Well, you're Ohio, New Jersey, and Michigan.
You're going to Michigan.
And well, yes, it's called Union. It's called Union Pier.
Yeah.
So it's, while it's in Michigan, it's just barely in Michigan, dangerously close to the state of Indiana.
Okay.
And inhabited.
I got it. I love you, Jack, but I got to keep it going.
Well, actually, I'm at the end. There's nothing else I can say.
I doubt that. Oh, I doubt that too. Speaking of Ohio, is coming on here. Anyone else new? Just truly new. Again, Marina. It's been a while. Albin. Eason.
Hey, everyone. My name is Albin. I run an RIA based in New York. I work out of Bryant Park, so if anyone's in Manhattan, you know, come say hi.
That's where we are.
I'm always in Manhattan.
Keep going.
Hi. Hello, I'm Izzy. I'm in the sunny Seattle today. Angel investor, technology specialist. Happy to be here.
Excellent. Welcome. Okay. Anyone else new? Looks like we got about 80 people here. I see Sean or Marina. Just one last try.
Yeah, Jose. Hi, everyone. Hi, Monk.
You want to just introduce yourself?
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. So hi, everyone. I'm Sean Chan. I'm based in Vancouver, BC, Canada. Or to my fellow Canadians, happy Canada Day. I'm still working, somewhat obviously. So I'm a board member of two family offices, one in Vancouver, one in New York, Global Solutions and Lyco Family. I'm also a partner of a $100 million VCP fund that invests in clean tech, life science, and agritech. And then on the side, I also run my own advisory business. Thank you.
Excellent. Welcome.
Yeah, cheers.
Last call. Okay. I'm going to let you transition slowly, Stephen, to get yourself ready. I'll stop sharing.
Thank you.
But if anybody else is still new, you can, like, Spencer, I feel like you can say hi.
I'm happy to say hi. I'm Spencer. I'm here in Salt Lake City with Summit Venture Studio. We had a great time on the West Coast tour in Palo Alto and then up to Seattle and met some nice people and made some new friends and looking forward to being here and potentially out on the East Coast. So. Thanks, Mark.
I want to get one of you guys at the Newport, not just the Hamptons. I'm going to turn it over to you, Stephen.
Thanks, Mark. So we wrap up a wild first 6 months of the year for the world, for the global economy, and for the markets. And we saw a 19% plunge in the S&P, Europe outperforming the U.S. for the first time in, I think, over a decade. We had a rebound in the markets based on a ceasefire between Israel and Iran that fueled the risk-on rally lately. And I think the volatility we experienced in the first half will remain with us for some time, leaving investors to wonder what now. And it's a fair question. So let's try and make sense of where we're headed. I want to focus on three topics, briefly touch on the de-escalation, talk about Fed independence, and then talk about the big, beautiful bill and what it means for the markets going forward. So let's get started. So the energy shock averted was a big deal. As for right now, we're in a de-escalation mode, although I think that's tenuous at best. But we have seen a surge in optimism as a result of that. The markets have rebounded globally pretty well. Oil prices have come down considerably, easing a lot of the concerns that people had. But really, the global economy dodged a bullet here with what was going on. And in particular, Asia dodged a big bullet. Roughly 80% of the crude and LNG that goes through the Strait of Hormuz is destined for Asia. This is a big relief for China, India, Japan, South Korea, and economically in the near term, but risks remain. Truces tend to be very tenuous, particularly in the Middle East. They're fragile at best. And the global risks still are prevailing with a lot to the downside of stagflation, demographics, trade issues, and limited fiscal space for governments to respond. We still have the positives of, in particularly for Europe, of the broad manufacturing capabilities driven by China, but other nations as well. Innovation continues to be on the rise in Asia, and they're dominant in so many key industries. So things could have gotten a lot worse. We have dodged a bullet for now. I would say that things are, you know, oil could bounce back up again, and that'll put a lot of strains on the system. But for right now, central banks have gotten some relief from the oil prices, and it's allowed, I think, a lot of countries to not resort to more aggressive policies that would have cost them more in the long run. So we have to be pleased with the de-escalation, but also have to keep in mind that it is not, we're not out of the woods here at all. Switching gears to the U.S. and mainly the president, the Fed chair, and the question of Fed independence, president came out with a pretty scathing note today to Powell comparing our rates to other countries' rates. I don't think that's the right way to look at it. I also think it's confusing what the Fed's role is. But really what we're seeing right now is the attack on the Fed's independence are unprecedented in the U.S., but we did see some examples of when fiscal policy gets out of line and central banks go in and support that, where it doesn't work out very well. You saw that in Japan in 06. You saw that a little bit in the U.K. with Liz Truss and that issue there. I think what's the president's trying to do will be counterproductive for a couple of reasons. One is the Fed chair doesn't set rates. It's the Fed voting members that do. There's 12 voting members. They value their independence considerably. They don't just set rates. They also control quantitative tightening, quantitative easing. So it is a big deal, and the Fed independence is going to remain a big deal. I think the president is making a big mistake trying to force the Fed to cover up for the inability of the U.S. to get our fiscal house in order and to keep doing the things we want to do to give away for everyone, do the giveaways, and not raise taxes. When we were in Seattle at dinner, I was talking to Jack and a couple people at the table, and I said that I think the big mistake the U.S. has made in the last 20 years is not following through on the Simpson-Bowles Commission report. And Ray Dalio was out today last night with a similar comment that we need to raise some taxes and we need to cut our spending. It's not that complicated to figure out how to get your house in order. What is complicated is the politics of it and dealing with the other issues. But I think Fed independence is going to be a big issue going forward. I think the president's going down a bad path, and I don't think, even if he puts in a shadow chair, will it have any effect in pushing the rates down as the president would like. I think the Fed governors will become even more strident in imposing a loss of independence, so I think that is a big issue. The president would like rates to be cut to 1% to lower interest payments, and it's costing us, you know, billions of dollars a day to have interest at the level it's at. You can see the CBO forecast is not having it come down. That is a problem, and it's a problem we're going to have to deal with. It's not realistic for the U.S. to go to 1% rates anytime soon. In fact, I'm of the camp that the Fed is around where they should be on rates. I know the administration would like to see them lower, and I could get the case for it, but I also understand Powell's case for not being in a rush to lower them because we don't know the full effects of inflation, of tariffs on inflation. The idea that tariffs are a one-time issue is correct if they're only adjusted one time. But as we've seen in the last quarter, the potential for tariffs to be moving around have been considerable. They've been on again, off again, and we have more to come in that area. So I think the uncertainty coming out of this has forced central banks to skew towards worrying about inflation because of the tariffs. The Bank of International Settlements came out with their annual report suggesting that this is a problem as well. I think it's going to remain a problem. I think we can't be too aggressive too soon to lower rates. I think that will be a problem. I think the issue really is the Fed can cut rates to bail out Congress when you have short-term issues facing you, like tariff uncertainty, like U.S.-China trade. So those things are going to be problematic. I think longer term, though, we have real structural issues with nations whose debt to GDP rises above these levels that we're projecting. And this is public debt moving above 100% on its way to 150%. And that is is directly related to lower growth and lower productivity over time. I think this is a real issue that we're going to be facing. And this is what the dilemma for central banks all around the world are and why they're not in as big a rush to cut rates for the short term. The other thing about rate cuts is when central banks start a rate cut cycle, it is not a one and done process. So you don't lower rates and then raise them again. You start a process to balance the rates to deal with the problem. And right now for the Fed, the problem that they're looking at is uncertainty around inflation and concerns about unemployment rising, which hasn't happened yet. And I think the Fed will be very cautious in cutting rates until they see the unemployment rate in the U.S. move up to around 4.5%. And we're really not, we're at 4.2 right now or around there. So I don't think they're feeling the pressure to move as much as the administration would like them to cover up the inability of Congress through multiple administrations to get our fiscal house in order. So Bloomberg did analysis of what the Fed speakers are saying and the Fed FOMC committee members are saying. And based on that, they've come up with sentiment scores, which basically say they're not in a rush to cut rates. As Powell has reinforced, the market believes there's a 16% chance of a rate cut in July. When I last looked, I think it's probably even lower now. I think their expectations are for September, and I'm not sure we'll see them then. I think there's just as good a chance we don't see a cut then as we do. That is an out of consensus view. So in the markets, the bull and bears are all making their cases right now. We're half of the year through. When you've had 15% declines or more in the S&P in the past, the market tends, and you've rallied back, the market tends not to continue to rally on. But that's in 3 out of the last 10 times it has, and I think this is, might be one of those times. The reason I believe that is I think innovation and resilience will win out. I believe that people are underestimating the impact of productivity enhancements coming from AI to counter inflationary pressures. I think the private sector will continue to be big spenders to offset the government spending cuts, government cuts that are going on. I think that the high-end consumer is also going to continue to drive it. And a big area that's underappreciated is the deregulation that is occurring through executive orders, can cut, it was about a 6% hit to GDP in the last administration, and deregulation, if done right, can be a big boon to the economy. If done wrong, it creates the next crisis. So I think that's the dilemma. On the bear side, we do have real stagflation fears. Market is as overvalued as it was at the start of the year. Earnings growth has been uneven, but you have seen the market broadening out. But while it's uneven, it's also highly uncertain because you don't know what the policies the company is going to be operating under. I think how the tariffs play out is uncertain, and I think the idea of one and done for tariffs in terms of inflationary impact has to be called into question because of the herky-jerky nature of the way the administration is administering them, the way the legal challenges are coming, and does it shift to where he has to get to sectoral tariffs, which could have a big impact on inflation, and that is a concern for central banks around the world. I think cost of living increases may slow consumer spending over time. I think it's already started on the low-end consumer, particularly the middle class. An immigration impact is real, and it's impacting the labor markets. I think the administration is trying to softly undo some of their policies around farmers, around farms, around restaurants and hospitality and healthcare because the impact there. But I think these are the two sides of the case. I skewed towards the more bullish case, but I understand both sides right now. I think we're going to remain in a highly uncertain period, mainly because the U.S. and China relation is so important, and you're seeing our deals with China and China's deals with the U.S. tend not to be very clear or fully executed on. I think the stuff that's top of mind for investors will remain there. I think we will find out how the tax bill plays out, but I think it goes back to the House, and the House will have some problems with the Senate changes, and they'll have to go another round. I don't think that's done yet. The central banks really have a dilemma in they can see the need for slowing growth to cut rates, but stagflation is a real issue, and they are worried about the inflationary impacts longer term of the policies that are being put in place around the world. And geopolitics is still in a very troubling state for the world. And through it all, we continue to hit new highs. And I think that's really the issue with innovation and productivity providing hope for investors to offset some of the negatives. So I'm skewing positive for the second half. I think technically the market in the U.S. is set up quite well. I do have some worries about the foreign markets having gotten a little ahead of themselves, and the pricing reflects a lot of the hope of the stimulus spend that's coming, particularly out of Europe. But I think that you'll see some challenges of rates staying a little bit higher for longer. For a lot of investments that require lower rates, I think they'll be disappointed in the near term and maybe through the second half of the year. So, Mark, I'm going to stop there and open up for conversation.
Cool. Again, everyone mute yourself if you aren't speaking, but Giovanni had your hand up.
Stephen, I may be tainted by my political leanings against Trump.
Yes.
Your view that, you know, the economy and the markets will pick back up because of productivity increases. The data that I've seen is that JP Morgan has a zero internship class, which is to say that interns and the grunt work that they did is worthless relative to the amount of time it takes for a managing director to teach or mentor the interns. And Google is buying out its employees. So how can productivity outweigh the fact that Google is firing people because of AI, and JP Morgan isn't even giving people a free job? How can you be so optimistic?
Yeah, I think the free jobs, well, I don't think they're all that free at JP Morgan to begin with, but I think the issue is you are going to be substituting capital for labor. I think this is really the dilemma you're touching on, Giovanni, is I have three or four kids in their 20s. Two of them are unhappy with their roles and looking for new ones. And this is not a great environment for that for young people. And I do think that is a challenge that governments are going to have to deal with in the short term. But for the companies, the fear of the big tech companies and the big banks and big employers all over was they overstaffed in the last couple of years because there was a talent war going on. And now they're letting go the people that they shouldn't have hired in the first place in many cases, because they were worried about being outbid by others. I think now you're actually seeing the real substitution of capital for labor, and that'll play out with the companies and with the markets and the economy over time. I think this gets to what does the government do to deal with that? And they're going to struggle right now in the short term. But overall, I think companies will be more productive. I think the economy will be more productive. I think we have to deal with the issues of who gets hurt by this as well. But I think you'll see a lot more, and you're seeing it all over the world, a lot of startups going on that are coming out of the problems that are being created. And that is how economies move forward when they have crises. And I think this is another crisis, and we'll deal with it.
Okay, Michael, thank you, Stephen.
I don't believe, Giovanni, to your political leanings, I don't believe in all the policies that are being put forth by this administration are ones that I favor. I think probably about 30% of what they do makes sense, and then the other 70% goes too far. I think that's for both parties, though, in the U.S. So I think they get about 30% right each.
Michael Keith.
Michael Daly.
Yes.
Hey, thanks, Stephen. Thanks, everybody, for joining. I wanted to pick on one of your favorite subjects, immigration. And my comment in the chat, I came across an article that California is missing 70% of its farm labor force. And what do you think the administration can possibly do on their current approach to ICE and raids, and how are we going to get people to pick the crops? Where do you think they're coming from? Are we going to get buses from the Midwest or what?
I think they'll stop. I think they'll do less on the exporting of the people that they're trying to get rid of, but not be public about it as they were about getting rid of them.
No, I mean, they're already gone. How we get them back?
I think they'll be workers don't have a problem getting here if they really want to. And we still have an excess. So I think people will find where they need to find it. I think it's a short-term problem that becomes less of a problem. And you look at the JOLTS numbers today too. It's, we have a lot of job openings.
I got to keep it going because there's so many people. Keith?
Mine is actually a follow-on Michael's comment. I have an ag tech startup who is hurting really bad this year because farmers have been hit by a triple whammy. The first was the raising of minimum wage in many states. The second is the impact of tariffs, making it impossible for them to export product to China and other locations. And the latest one, obviously, is the mass deportation or ICE raids, not only in California now, but we're seeing it in eastern Washington, basically wiping out the workforce, which is not going to be able to support farm harvest this fall. And so I guess, Stephen, what I'm looking for in the crystal ball and the question I have is, do we see the government taking any action, or are they going to basically just let this entire season fail?
I think the answer is they'll take action and the season may fail anyway, because it's too late for some of the problems, but there are other issues. This is where, you know, the issue of productivity improving doesn't mean that all the people that don't have jobs get jobs, or all the things that we have made problems in the short term get fixed right away. But when you go through the process like big tech is going through to eliminate the jobs they're eliminating, those companies will be producing much higher earnings, much higher revenues. And new businesses will be spinning off starting from that. That's where it comes in. It's like after the great financial crisis, you didn't rebound right away, but you did see new businesses coming in and you see the shifts coming in. We are a very adaptable and resilient global economy. And I think that we discount that when things are really negative. And, you know, they're not going to solve, Keith, your problem for this harvest necessarily, but they are reacting to the issues. And I think I think the voters will be pushing that way too.
Thank you.
So we're still a year away from the midterms now. You know, it's not that far that the midterms are up.
So. Andrew Fish.
Stephen, you talked about markets getting ahead of themselves. We've hit record earnings yield / P ratio, record price to sales. It's not the Magnificent Seven. It's all large caps. Russell 2000 is nowhere. So at what point do we look at the S&P 500 at very, very high P ratios and get worried?
Well, I would expect that after we've had a 20% move or 25% move up like we've had off the bottom, that at the very least we'll consolidate, if not experience a pullback. In the short term, I don't think it's I think it's more of a 5 to 10% type thing, as you have a lot of the issues that you guys are raising right now will be front and center of people's mind. And I think that that next step will be the opportunity to step in and buy again. So I think that's, I get the roll with the waves that are coming. Andrew, as you've seen all year, we've had a very volatile market, and I think it'll continue to be that way. And you take the advantage of the things when they are given to you. And I would advise trimming when you're at these levels for things that have gotten ahead of themselves, even if
overall still bullish at these levels and 5-10% notwithstanding.
Right? Yeah, I think a broadening out of the market has gone on. I think you're seeing a change in leadership. I think we go through those periods where every 10 years or so, the top 10 companies have a cleaning out and new companies come in. And I think we're starting to see that with the new names that are coming out, like the Palantirs and the, a bunch of the new names that are coming up that are weren't talked about a year ago and now are front and center in the public eye.
A few more questions here. Charles, then Anthony.
Hi, good morning. This is very interesting what you said, Stephen. I think the question I'd like to ask is, and you've obviously put a lot of focus on the innovation economy being a key staple of the conversation on where capital would be going to or will be a key driver. We've obviously seen allocations to VC as well as just VC allocations to startups come down to an all-time low. Where do you see that sort of balance coming back into play, where if there is a this need and this directive towards an innovation economy, how do you actually see that deployment start to come back?
I think we clearly need to purge. We need a clearing in the private markets, right? We've known that. We've talked about it. You're seeing it with the secondaries. I think it comes from the private sector, and I think it's the big companies are going to be driving it. I think you'll look at the big tech. They've made so many acquisitions in the last couple of years that they're just now going to start focusing on cultivating. And I think you'll see spinoffs coming from a lot of these companies as well. And I think the combination of the big companies focusing on the drivers that they have inside their portfolios already that can unlock a lot of innovation, and then the spinoffs that I expect will be coming in new startups. I think that's where it comes from, and the capital. You know, there's no shortage of capital out there. You know, we're looking at consumer net worth at record levels of $175 trillion or something like that. It's, you know, pretty significant. The financial crisis is $51 trillion. So the economy is much bigger, the market's much bigger, and I think there's a lot of capital that's waiting to get put to work. So I think that's where it comes from, the sidelines.
If we could go quickly, and Anthony, got to be really quick because we got to switch. It's already past 11:30.
Hi, it's Anthony. Andy, my dear friend, with great respect, I think if I either misheard or to Andy's point, which I think is significant, it's not the Russell that sprouted forward. And just to tie it in, the mega large caps, which for the most part were dominated by tech/consumer, their earnings have increased in 2025. And, I think that's just significant because that feeds into the mantra of being able to do more with less. vis-a-vis people, employees, and so on. Could Andy just respond to that so Stephen can chime in and we can just be clear on that?
The large caps have become Palantirs and Ubers are all making new highs, but if you look at their revenues relative to their market cap, they literally have to wrought miracles to bring them into. So they're large cap simply by the fact that their capitalization, not by the fact that their businesses generate such large revenues.
Guys, we got to keep going. Samir Allen, are these, make them quick if you could.
Yes. Just wanted to, it's probably not a quick discussion point, but just mayoral election in NYC, right? What it implies more than anything for, I guess, policy, right? It's sort of a bellwether. Any comments are appreciated.
I'm not sure what to make of it other than it's fascinating watching the two political parties fighting with each other more than they're fighting with inside their parties than fighting with the other parties right now. In DC, yeah. You have the Republicans doing that. In New York, you have, and around the states, you have the Democrats trying to figure out which way the party goes. Is that a winning move or not? And I think the jury's out.
Fair enough. Alan?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, we're in another evolutionary period here. Similar to SaaS, where it just ripped out all of the IT departments in many companies. You know, AI is doing the same thing. Innovation's always been the 10x multiplier. I've been in the Bay Area since 98, and, you know, you have this massive fear gauge as companies shift into these titanic, you know, internal ships. And they level themselves out. It's a pendulum swing right now. We're working, you know, we're launching a new fund towards Africa, working with a company called Turing Labs, a agentic AI company, and they are, you know, their goal is to provide that 10x multiplier, that McKinsey for the inside of the organization. And it is a complete
pitch or a statement.
No, it's a pitch. Well, listen, it's a pitch to them because what they're doing for us is incredible. But I'm just saying it's completely changed the way that we think about research and other individuals of how we hire. It makes you a completely lean organization. And then it goes back to VC and, you know, it's a downward trend because you can invest in much leaner companies now with what's being built up. This is a 5-person team that's built this with, you know, more than 30, LLM models.
Anyway. Alan, you're going to introduce this tech investing deep dive every time because that was a perfect segue to what we're about to talk about.
Thanks.
So I asked to have, some brief perspectives on different ways to invest in tech. So Rafiq Ahmed from Chicago, Diplo Ventures was with us on the West Coast. I think he's sort of like, I was looking at Jennifer Garner from Denison, doing improv. Like I could give you a subject and I think you could just handle it, Rafiq.
Just don't ask me to talk about AI and manufacturing and like,
well, that's what you're about to talk about. That's what I wanted to talk about. Then we have Julia, also from Chicago. Chicago is being overrepresented today, scaling health tech, and she's got some. She's been part of our community for a very long time. And then Nelson Stacks is on his third tech transfer out of Harvard. So that's another thing. I think the guys from like Taylor Bench from Summit Venture Labs. They also, that's their model. And then, Jonathan, we didn't really have a chance. I know I came up with a headline that you might disagree with, but you're in the Beltway and you do leverage distilled intelligence. So I'm going to let Rafiq go, if it's okay. I know I'm going to lose some people, so let go. Rafiq, Jonathan, and I'll let Julia or Nelson go third and fourth. And then if anybody wants to focus on the tax, that we're talking about the tax bills, that's tomorrow at 10:30. We're getting that deep dive for next week. So, Rafiq, over to you.
Yeah, hey, everyone. Rafiq Ahmed, Diplo Ventures.
You have the wrong screen up.
I have the wrong screen up. Okay.
Actually, I have my screen up, so let me stop sharing.
Okay. Can everyone see this?
There you go. Ooh, that looks like Chicago.
That looks like Chicago. Okay. So just a quick intro. Rafik Ahmed, DiPaolo Ventures. So we are early stage deep tech investors here in the heartland, middle of the country. We focus on hard tech, but we love software. Who doesn't? And are looking at applications of AI where it makes sense. But we lead with hard tech. We're not afraid of it. Ex-Motorola Google team. And honestly, we love the valuations that we find outside the Bay Area, New York, Boston, and so we lean into it. Where's Jack? He was talking about
the Columbus, Midwest.
Yeah, in Ohio,
being
the ecosystem that he's you know, certainly investing in. And so it's like that here. Lots of interesting ecosystems around the country, lots of innovation. So anyway, thank you for having me, Mark. And so we're going to talk a little bit about sort of the Midwest mismatch, why you should be looking between the coasts if you're not already. So first of all, I guess the last couple of years, the deep, I think the screen's working now. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So the deep malaise in venture, everyone coming out of it, thinking that the first quarter or the first half was going to be, you know, good tailwinds. We had other things like tariffs, et cetera, going on. But these numbers aren't great. Market moving back to coast is not what I want to hear. Chicago, I think, got up to about $6 or $7 billion in annual VC activity before the big meltdown. So the first quarter number here of 0.6 billion, 74 deals, isn't something I'm going to be super excited by, but I think we're probably coming out of the bottom of that, and the second half should be better. I mean, compare that to Bay Area, Boston, New York, obviously, are well in the lead. Seattle, where we were a couple of weeks ago, coming in strong at 2.1 billion. So the coasts get most of the attention. But look at the number of unicorns that are happening. Obviously, the Bay Area blows that away. 125 plus is in red. But if you look at the rest of the country, there is unicorn activity. If you look at the center of the country, going all the way down to Texas, going into Florida, going through the Midwest, there's a lot of activity here, which means there's untapped potential, and that's what we look for. But the other thing, too, about investing in tech is we're not just looking for unicorns. I think there tends to be this chasing unicorns and where can you produce them the fastest. There is a case to be made for maybe more moderate returns, M&A activity being the exit path, and that's also okay.
Well,
so if you
high returns but shorter duration, we don't have to wait for the unicorn moment. Is that what you're saying, or you think we should accept moderate returns in the Midwest?
I think sometimes you have to accept moderate returns. There's only so many unicorns to go around, right? I mean, so we look for solid companies and we look for exit potentials out of those. I mean, I have a unicorn in my angel portfolio, fantastic, but do I expect one in my fund portfolio? Not necessarily. So that's not sort of the gating factor, perhaps.
Yeah.
So what I'm calling Midwest arbitrage, some might call the mismatch. If you look at the percentage of US VC, 3.8%, but we have a 65% advantage over West Coast valuations. And that is a huge, huge differential. So you may or may not have heard some of these things, but if you look at great universities, if you look at talent, if you look at some of the work going on in new tech areas, the Midwest is not lagging. Yes, we went through Berkeley, we went to Stanford, we talked about the number of patents coming out of there a couple of weeks ago when we were on the West Coast, but Chicago has number two and number three biz schools in the country, in Booth and Kellogg. We have two national labs here. We have quantum leading. Denver is another area where quantum is leading. If you're looking at nuclear, if you're looking at clean tech, so all these things are super interesting out here.
Just a few more minutes.
In terms of an indicator of unicorns, maybe, or at least companies that are going to scale well, 100 million plus companies founded. So this is an interesting chart. So pull that out. Heydays were back in 2014 and 15. This is the year of the company getting founded. So if you look at the last few years, 2023, we already have a $100 million company being founded. So that, again, may not be amazing if it's a software only situation, but in the Midwest, I think that's a very decent sort of track record for Chicago. And then finally, we have further macro tailwinds. Can't deny the fact that manufacturing is coming back and reshoring. PMI numbers this morning were pretty solid. The reality is, of course, you can't bring manufacturing back that quickly. But in terms of what we're doing at DiPaolo, this is a little bit of a snapshot into our world. So it's not tech broadly, but it's tech with a core in hardware. And it's a lot of different things around food and ag and clean energy, consumer devices, med tech. So there's a lot here. Welcome you guys to come out, see Chicago. We have Tech Week coming up, July 23rd. Aspen Institute is going to do their Climate Week as well. We're involved with that. Hit me up if you want to find out more info.
And as many of you know, and if you don't, we did the Midwest tour after COVID. We went Chicago, Detroit, Ann Arbor, Cincinnati, Columbus, Cleveland. We almost went to Chicago, or Pittsburgh and Buffalo. I know Buffalo's. I think the Midwest starts in Buffalo.
Excuse me.
You gotta come back. Yeah.
Rafiq, will we be able to have access to this presentation?
Yes, absolutely. I can. I think it's going to be part of Mark's. Mark,
you can.
Oh yeah, you are recording.
And also you can put your contact info. We should go to you, Julia, because he's teed you up with Chicago. But you're not just doing Chicago. Neither are you, Rafiq. But I'm worried that we're going to lose Jonathan, so I'm going to let him go to the fore. And you may not have slides, Jonathan, but just if you could give us some insights into how you see the tech world today.
Sure. I do have a few slides, if that's okay, Mark.
Okay. No pitching. Go ahead.
No. Thank you for the opportunity, everyone. Jonathan Pirelli with 4to5 Ventures Fund 2. Very simply, I agree with Rafiq. There's a lot of great companies at great valuations outside of Silicon Valley. We are based in D.C. with an office in New York and one in L.A. I'm just going to cruise through. Forgive me for sliding here. Real quick results on Fund 1 for us. We had one company at a $500 million exit valuation that was called IntraHive. Hinge was acquired by Match. We're the first investor in Hinge at under $1 million valuation. That's a multi-billion dollar property now. And IDME, we still hold shares in. So at a 2.53x DPI, we did really well with Fund 1. And we still have, I think, room to get to 5x with IDME. They're talking about going public. And then some other acquisitions here, Flexi by Pinterest. All these companies we found through a pitch event that we host ourselves. We've hosted it twice before, 500, then 1,500 attendees in D.C. We're now hosting it October 14th, 15th, 16th at a Lansdowne Resort. Loudoun County, Virginia is the wealthiest county in the country. They're co-hosting the event with us. It's Data Center Alley, tons of energy companies, defense, cyber, quantum. And we're excited about this event. So we have a discount code. I think it's 361MARK. Mark, I'll send that to you for $200 off the ticket.
That's interesting. Okay.
You know, MARK. I hope you like that.
Yeah.
It's an event that includes, I think it's 9 meals over 2.5 days. We have $1 million pitch event paired with a Davos for startups. So think about industry specific verticals. So we'll have hardware, cyber, software, cyber. VCs, angels, and founders and operators in those circles playing pickleball and cornhole against each other. We're going to have a ton of fun. We already have, I think, almost 200
people.
We're not
competitive, Jonathan. We don't play pickleball. Wait until you see our crowd come and join you.
There's golf and tennis as well. So we bought out the whole resort. We're going big because we want people to be able to relax and get to know each other, mostly investors getting to know investors. That's how deals are done, as we all know. And a couple of just real quick, Mark, stats, team, I'm going to go straight to our current funds, our portfolio.
Well, maybe just if you could, focus on a theme. What's a theme that you think we should be thinking about today?
Well, for our region, defense, cyber and energy are massive. There are companies coming out of the woodwork, and a lot of them are founders coming from large companies, finding a niche problem and solving it. And we're seeing valuations under the typical $20 million series seed. So we're excited in the same way Rafiq is for valuations that are outside of Silicon Valley. We always have had those. And the themes that we also see are human health, which we've got two of our four current first deals in, and future of work. AI is changing everything fundamentally, and we believe that, you know, vertical AI platforms are things we'll invest in.
All right, you've just set up Julia.
Perfect.
Julia.
Thank you.
Health. What did you call it, Jonathan?
Human health.
Human health. And what is that? How do you define that?
We define it as anything for currently med tech devices and software. So we have Samfire Neuroscience is a device that helps women through chronic pain related to perimenopause, menopause, endometriosis, PMS, different health platform company that is first customers, Goldman Sachs, where they have a performance lab set up on site for blood tests, MRIs, et cetera. So we run the game. Outside of biotech.
Okay.
Well, Jonathan, I'd love to chat with you later about some of the health stuff you're doing.
Yes, Rafiq, but yeah. Love to. Thank you.
I'd love to see all four of you co-invest on something. Okay, so Julia, does any of that resonate?
Very much so. Thank you for all those great introductions. It sounds like we have amazing areas where we can collaborate.
So you take over from here, Julia.
Okay, sounds good. I have a few slides. I'd like to open your mind today on how to generate outsized returns in healthcare software. My name is Julia Monfrini-Pieve. I've been investing in healthcare for 17 years now. I started almost like an AA meeting. I invested $1 billion in the space, including in private equity, and now taking that experience, knowledge, expertise, and networks to early stage healthcare tech. Let me explain to you why we can drive outsized returns. One, healthcare is a massive part of the economy, almost a fifth. We all know it. It's $4.5 trillion. It's a very complex space to invest into. I've been doing this for 15 years in the US, and I'm still a humble tourist given the complexity it has. Therefore, specialized manager tend to outperform generalists by as much as 700 bips. So if you're looking for alpha, specialized people is a great way to look into. Healthcare is slow to adopt anything. It is so because patient safety is at the core, because you need to generate clinical evidence. And therefore, Bessemer Ventures, actually, their data showed that it takes twice as long to get to $10 million ARR. But when the sector adopts, it's very sticky. It's very resilient. Second fact you may not know about healthcare tech investing, exits are smaller than what most people think when we talk about a $4.5 trillion industry. Most exits are between $200 and $400 million. Only 5% of the exit by counts get over $1 billion. So actually, small is beautiful. How do we make money in that space? We make money by coming in early. On the left side, you see the chart of a traditional venture fund based upon the power law. The power law doesn't work well in healthcare for the two facts I just gave. On the right, you see our performance. We came in early. We did a more concentrated portfolio. We provided more support. We exited once the companies got the sweet spot, so we already have an exit. What it means in healthcare tech, you actually need to take a private equity growth equity approach in order to make money. Healthcare is an amazing place to invest in. I've been doing this through cycles. Even now, it's not recession proof, but it is recession resistant. People get hurt, continue to go to the hospitals. Hospitals have no choice but implementing technology these days, software, to one, drive revenues, two, cut costs, three, sometimes improve patient outcomes, but primarily the first two. So actually the pipeline of our companies have continued to accelerate in the last 6 months, despite the chaos in the macro environment. We at Pace go where others don't look. We're based in Chicago. One, it has great advantages in terms of valuation. As Rafiq highlighted, we're also at the center of healthcare. All corporations are based here. We've done a proof of concept fund one, which is currently outperforming top decile VC funds. Mark, you have a question?
You can't show performance.
I can't show performance.
In a meeting
that's
like
us. That's what we do in short. Happy to answer any questions you may have on the sector.
Okay. Well, we're going to go into breakouts. There'll be one for Julia, one for Rafiq. Actually, Jonathan, you may not be able to stick around, but let's last but definitely not least on his third Harvard tech transfer opportunity, we have Nelson Stacks.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to hear all the other presenters. Mark and I just chatted last night, so I don't have any slides. I was just told to talk for about 3 minutes, so I'm going to make it quick. My presentation today or discussion is really about out-licensing. And the most important factor to consider, in my opinion, is, you know, what is this group likely to – how are they to deal with? If it's a university or if it's a corporation. In my case, I've spun technologies out of both Harvard and MIT, and they've been absolutely fantastic. They get the model. They understand the university makes money by taking a small percentage, and they're successful if the startup is successful. So instead of asking for everything in the world up front from the startup, they really get, they become wealthy the more success that the university, the university becomes more successful, the better the startup becomes. So they're not asking for everything up front. And so I'll give you an example of an issue where we had a problem. One of my companies, all the other companies have been successfully sold, but one of my companies, we're doing the clinical trials, and Stanford is a fantastic place. Unbelievable technology has been generated from Stanford, but this is just an example that happened to us. We had negotiations in place for clinical trials, and everything was set. We're about to begin the patient trials for a particular new device, and then literally the last minute, like a week before we were going to start patients at Stanford, they call us up and they said, "Hey, we got to renegotiate." What do you mean, renegotiate? We're done. I said, "Yeah, we need 300% increase in the price per patient than what we'd agreed." And we said, you know, that's just a non-starter. We can't afford to do that. And we found another hospital. Everything went well. We successfully sold the company. But my point is, understand the group that you're going to get in bed with. And just because the deal is signed doesn't mean it's over.
But Nelson, just to clarify, that last minute change came from whom?
Stanford University.
From the university itself. Okay.
Hospital system within Stanford. We were going to do about 300 patients from Stanford. And they just said, "Hey, by the way, we're going to need a." If it was 7,000, we're going to need 21,000 per patient. Like, what? That's a massive increase. And so we skipped Stanford and went to some surrounding hospitals on the West Coast, and everything worked out great. So, yeah, the other factor to consider to be truly successful is understanding how the technology that you're going to license might be used. If it's a molecule, you're a lot more restricted. If it's a device or something that can be put into a device, then you have a lot more flexibility in how you can structure that deal with the university, the corporation. So if it's a device, you might think about razor blade model if that works. And if so, how much of the university is going to get? Are they going to get purely the revenue? Is it going to be the revenue on the razor blade or the razor? In my case, our company now, we structured everything on the razor because we'll sell less razors than razor blades. I don't want to give Harvard, you know, it's fair. Harvard's going to get money, but I'm not going to commission them on every razor blade if the foundation of the technology really was for the razor.
Do you mind explaining what do they receive on the razor?
Yeah, so they get a small revenue, so a single digit percentage of the sale price. But even that, let me now break that down. So if I sell the razor for $10, and I say I'm going to give you 5%, 6%, 3% of every razor, okay, great. Mm-hmm. But this is the other point I want people to understand: is you can also structure the revenue share from the razor itself. So the razor might cost $10, mm-hmm. but I only attribute the portion that I license from Harvard to a percentage of the $10. So I'm not giving them 5% of the $10. I'm saying, well, of the razor I sell, the technology in the razor is $3. The software that goes into the razor is $4. And then some additional work is another $3. So I'm only going to give you 5% of the $3 of the $10 for every sale. So that's what I want to get across. It's a lot of flexibility that you have, and you really have to be.
Got it. How many universities have you dealt with?
I was a venture capitalist for a long time with the Kauffman Fellow before I went into operating. So I've dealt with many.
You did Stanford, Harvard, any other universities?
MIT, University of Chicago. So, you know, I've structured.
Who's your favorite?
MIT is hands down the best. They just get it. They're just easy to work with. They're not trying to screw the entrepreneur. They get, like, we're going to be better off by 10 companies spinning out of here than trying to suck all the revenue out of one.
Rob Colorine's got a question. Is it for Nelson, Rob?
It's actually for a couple of them. With respect to what was going on the fundraising side, all of you guys presented great stories. how come it's that difficult, and how are you guys going to sort of navigate sort of the those either difficult or slow waters on the fundraise?
I'll let everyone hit the navigation, but what I heard this week three times, I'll invest in venture once I get my money back, back in those vintages. So it's an opportunity and a crisis that I think someone was saying earlier, but I'll let the speakers maybe we'll do this question and then we'll go breakouts. How are each of you navigating today in this difficult venture environment? Maybe whoever wants to go first. Julia wants to go first.
I can start. I can just say, you know, raising money is my wife always says to me, she's like, are you done? I mean, yeah, it's just crazy. Never said to me, now is a great time to raise money unless you do an AI, some kind of startup. So I say, you know, this is what I do. This is what I get. So the key right now, I believe, is, you know, you have to de-risk as much as possible. You know, investors are willing to take on risk if the, you know, the exit profile is there, but even so, they want as little risk as possible. So for the entrepreneur, you know, keep it in the university as long as you can. Try to have as many proof points, positive points as possible. And if you can have some kind of, you know, external validation on either technology, sales, something that, you know, as they say, the old Harvard article was, will the dogs buy the dog food? That the dogs are, in fact, willing to buy this dog food. It's not just a pipe dream. It has legs to it. But I'll let others speak as well.
A couple of things. I think in the current environment, someone made the point earlier, there is actually a lot of capital sitting on the sideline. There is just a liquidity issue and a lack of appetite for increased risk in venture when credits can pay that much. So two things we've done. One is we've led with our performance, which again is top desire, et cetera, et cetera. Two, we've welcomed more smaller checks that will increase commitments over time. But from investors, we want to have in the long run, even if they start smaller than we would love them to be. Also, we built a relationship with a strata trust that actually handles IRA direct investments. And we've closed on actually millions of dollars that way.
Yep. Actually, I'm seeing JP. JP McKinney, how are you navigating this? And then we'll go on to the others.
Yeah, still here. So first of all, the emerging managers in 2019 through 22 spent a lot of money at too high valuation. We all know that was the problem. Past performance is actually an indicator of future success. I know we hear it all the time that it shouldn't be, but what we believe is getting in early, getting in at the right valuations and being a leader. This is why we host our event. That's how we see our way around it. We host our own event. We bring together the ecosystem and together we find the great deals. It worked for us in the past twice. We believe it'll work this time. That's how we see ourselves working around it, working through it. But the reality is it's a slog. If you're raising a fund, instead of talking to 300 folks, you've got to talk to 900. That's the reality these days.
So I hear you on that. What we're trying to do is, you know, this is 2025. We're in the age of AI. And we're trying, at least as 361, and we're in a beta. But it's if you can go – so, Rob, you asked the question. You know, Rob is affiliated with a group that knows manufacturing. They're somewhat global. If you can find exactly what that investor lines up with, the more you understand that your investor, and I used to say with Facebook and LinkedIn, there's no excuse. Now we have AI. Know your investors and be ready for and target them and be ready for those discussions. I don't know Rafiq or anyone
yeah,
else?
Mark, this is JP.
Oh, yes,
you had asked me a quick question. It's consistent with just about everybody else. You know, you get up and you smile and dial. And that's pretty much all there is to it at this point. You know, it's finding the right investors that believe in the particular thesis. You know, ours is all around defense logistics, supply chain, you know, dual use commercial supply chain logistics, mobility, you know. Oh, you know, if you want to just do pure AI, we ain't for you. You know, we have a ton of AI associated with everything that we're going for, but you know, we're not a generalist. And you know, if people are looking for specialists, that's who we want to work with. And people that believe in the mission. And we've got a mix of just about everybody in here. You know, and as Julia had mentioned, the IRA investments. We have a lot of those folks. You know, that are executive types that believe in the mission and we're able to raise from different things, but we're also building micro funds. You know, I'm not going to try and build a massive fund at this point. We've got so many opportunities. If we can fund them fast, we can do deals and just keep building micro funds as we go.
I think that's a good point. I think it's not perfect, but it's doing some of these deal specific SPVs is a way to, is one navigation. Rafiq, you want to hit it?
My two cents, I guess, just a parting thought is, you know, there used to be a time when venture capital was about taking big bets and having the balls to be in this space. And I feel like we've come into a time where we're having to appease just about everybody across the investing landscape. And it's not about patience, and it's not about letting things take the time that it takes to bake. Some of this tech you can't do in 3-4 year cycles. It's just not meant to be. So I think it's dysfunctional. I think something's, you know, broken. Yeah, we can do rolling funds and SPVs and quick, you know, closes and move to the next numerical number. So, but yeah, hopefully there's a better day coming, and some of the early, you know, I guess sentiment around why venture capital can make a return, but I'm probably being too optimistic.
So I wanted to break out, but I see Andy and Carolina. Andy, you spoke earlier. Carolina, do you want to speak first, if you don't mind?
Hi there. Yeah, so just quickly, I think Rafiq touched on it very briefly. But so we saw Lightspeed recently and other Silicon Valley VC funds transforming into registered investment advisors. And obviously there's new forms that VCs evolving. I was wondering if your deployment model is still 10 years, or are you thinking about other forms as well?
Was that a question to me? Our deployment model for the second fund is 10 years, but we've done transitional SPVs that act as mini pools, if you will, with more than one asset. We're kind of too small to think about too many things like an RIA. Bigger platforms would be better suited to those types of things. Yeah, you know. Is there such a thing as a 5-year or 7-year? I mean, in Europe, you do have 7- and 8-year terms, but it's not really venture assets as much as maybe renewable projects, things like that. It's really difficult to get away from a 10-year term. I mean, if somebody's got great ideas around that, I'd love to chat.
Well, we did have a secondaries panel, which you should all watch that from Menlo Park. Was our second annual. We'll do another secondaries. But I, again, Andy, I'm going to pause on you again. Tammy's new. Bring her in.
Hello. Quick question. So one of my multiple hats is I work at Lojas, and we help, and this isn't about Lojas. This is genuinely about my question. But we help a lot of our clients are funds and fund of funds and founders that are doing raises. A lot of them are women led or working on community development. And what we help them do is bring in, and we're not the only ones, Impact Assets and others, but bringing in nonprofit philanthropic capital into the capital stack. So going to investors to go back to their DAFs and get them to de-risk that way. So I don't know if that type of strategy has moved into the AI space. I feel like it's natural to do it, at least in the health and wellness part. But I didn't know if any of you are deploying strategies of going in the funds that you're doing to your investors and bringing in some of that either recoverable grants or donor advised fund capital.
Or maybe that's a question of anybody with a DAF. Are you doing any of that?
Yeah.
Anyone on this call wants to speak up? Because this is not just about the panelists, it's about us all talking.
My DAF is too small, so not yet, but maybe one day.
Anyone else?
No, Mark, we're in the same boat. I mean, we're relatively too small. I mean, it's possible with some really, really small foundations out there that we know, but it's typically too risky for what they
want. I think the point that I is making it for you, Tammy, is that their sort of mission or values align investing opportunities, and small is not the issue. They can do whatever sizes.
They can do 5,000. It doesn't. That's the flexibility of DAFs. Is you decide whoever's doing the raise decides the minimum, so it's the money they wrote off anyway.
So Rafiq answered it from the perspective of having his own DAF, but from their DAFs can be rather large or small, all different kinds. Here's another person. I like new voices. So Glenn, are you going to talk about DAFs? Or are you going to talk about real estate? What are you going to talk about, Glenn?
No, I was going to go back to VC, if that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I just had a question for the VC savvy folks on the phone. Having just exited back in 2023 from a VC in the biotech sector with a $1.1 billion exit, are you starting to see that a lot of the assets that are in these VC firms as they come to the end of their funds with maybe some of the lack of returns that they didn't expect? Are you seeing some of the assets that still have legs moving into secondary funds or something along that line, continuation vehicles of some sort?
Anyone?
So yes, CVs have been the name of the game for the last year. It kept law firms and peers busy. I think I wish I actually had some liquidity to go buy some of those assets for pennies on the dollar, because many have good business models, commercial traction, strong teams, but just bad balance sheet. Valuations were too high 3 years ago. You can never exit it at that level. So might as well offer an opportunity and rewrite the upside.
And some of them just need more time.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah, particularly the deep tech bits. All right, Andy, go.
Thank you.
Andy, you're on mute.
My comment was right there anyway, was that first is that healthcare has not had the valuation hockey stick over the last decade that you've seen in other sectors. Two, that, and I did my first 25 years ago, and my recent co-invest with a biotech ran off 2 years ago. The underlying investments at least are proven themselves in much, much more short order than typical empire building Silicon Valley type investments that take decades or more. And so healthcare, really the argument is that one, you can have these shorter timeframes and yeah, maybe you need to actually exit a little longer, but the proof of concept and business development and all of that can be much sooner. The biotech fund only did phase two. Doesn't take more than 3 years. So they buy phase one, just do phase two, live, die, sell it, whatever. So we did it in less than 5 years. So the argument to people investing in VC is one, valuations were not elevated. Two is the time frame should be shorter to measure success, however you measure it. And so you shouldn't look at it in the same view. And I haven't seen continuation funds in healthcare. I've seen them in a lot. My inbox is full of them in other places.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Any other comments?
Mark, yeah. I just want to add on DAFs. I'm seeing some interesting things happening where, I think people are trying to organize DAF funds to come into venture and PE. At scale. So, not individual DAFs, but foundation DAFs, et cetera. We have a fund of funds here in Chicago who are kind of split their strategy between raising capital from institutional LPs, but then the other half of it is from DAF. So there are some exciting things happening in DAF for sure.
Right. Hey, Mark, I've got a report that I'll share with you and you can share with the community. Bobby Franklin from the NBCA spoke at Investment West last month, yeah, May. And he had a really good presentation. He sort of had a state of the US VC market with a lot of bullet points. So it was publicly released. So I'll shoot it to you. And if you want to send it out to the community, it answers a lot of questions here and gives a bunch of statistics that they pull from a lot of this from PitchBook and their own research, but it's pretty interesting, and it's got a focus on the Midwest angle as well. So it might be beneficial to folks. So I'll email it to you, and you can shoot it off.
Sounds good. I saw Spencer Walker. I saw your note just on the whole tech transfer. Do you want to just share a bit like what you guys are doing in that angle?
Yeah, I was just thinking about, the schools that do a lot of spin outs from tech transfer, they should be good at it. And I think MIT and Stanford are kind of recognized for that, but there's other schools out there that are doing, 15 or 20 startups a year, with varying degrees of success. And so,
can you, Can you provide that report that you guys do on schools?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be in there in just a minute.
And JP, you don't have to just email it to me. Just put it in the chat. Share it if you don't.
Can I put an attachment in here?
Yes.
I'll try it.
Anyone else? Perspectives? Parth, I've seen you on camera. You're in Austin. I've heard, I want to be provocative, far from, be it for me. I've heard everything from, you know, Austin is great, it's edgy, but nothing's really happening in Austin. What's happening in Austin?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I think I'm a bit biased having grown up in Austin and spent the majority.
I enjoyed our time in Austin, by the way, but.
Yes, it was wonderful.
Can I get you to Newport? Are you going to join us in Newport?
I will. I'll be in Newport on, here in 2.5 weeks.
Perfect.
So look forward to seeing everyone there. You know, yeah, when it comes to Austin, I think that, that a lot of the exciting things are happening, right? When I was growing up, really Dell, IBM, and, I mean, there were a couple of others, but we're mainly the only games in town, right? And now you're seeing a lot more, even large corporations move to Austin, but there's a lot of exciting work and innovation happening, especially I would say in the technology space, right? And as a result of that, I think Austin is now on the map, so to speak. You're seeing a lot of managers, some of the VC firms we've invested with previously. Austin's kind of one of their stops now on the roadshow. From an LP perspective, I don't think the ecosystem is still as robust as a lot of the other larger cities, and is certainly still overshadowed by larger Texas markets, whether that be Houston or Dallas. But again, I'm biased, but I think a lot of exciting stuff is happening in Austin. And if any of you are in the area in the coming months, please let me know, reach out, and I'd be more than happy to host you, and I would love to get together.
Parth, question. Do you play pickleball or cornhole?
I play it all.
Okay. So you got to join us.
It is a little too hot though in July.
But in Virginia, where Jonathan's hosting us in October, I think it's going to be perfect weather.
I would be honored.
I was told early in my career that you make money in venture early or in secondaries. You have to come in early, or you have so much money and access that you can get into the best funds where the top tiers are. Also throwing that out. Anyone else want to add? I guess we're not doing breakouts today. We're going to have community discussion.
Mark, I just dropped that file in the chat. Sorry, it took a little bit to
upload. Thank you, JP. Anyone else?
Hey, Mark, it's Rob. Just thanks for addressing my question on the uncertainty. Whatever. I guess one silver lining is that if a family office or high net worth or whatever does step up, and I like Tammy Kesselman's point too, that even at these the endowment and foundation side, they may not be as bureaucratic if you've got the right sponsorship. Or the other angle is if you get a certain brand in, it leads to others. So the twofold: one is that on sort of some quasi anchors, and secondly, there's advantage to the investor that, you know, hopefully if you go in during tough times, there's a relationship loyalty of coming in early and things go well. You know, there'll be obviously preemptive rights, but more just relationship benefits that the GP will recognize. I just want to throw that out to you, Mark, and see if you or one of the GPs thought similarly.
Or LPs, if anyone wants to weigh in. Thank you. Anyone? Rob Colorini just threw a softball.
Okay, It's fine. And some folks don't want to consider sort of lower valuations or what have you, but it's an interesting market dynamic right now, what I'm seeing.
Hey, Rob, we met at Super Return in Miami earlier this year. Just wanted to say hi.
Good to see you again.
I think the secondary market and all of its dynamics and manifestations is an interesting, just, I guess, you know, you, since we're actually, some people are in the waiting room. It really tells us where the market is. So, cause if you can buy low with this great discounts for all kinds of reasons, you have the ability to, you should do that before you go into a new fund. At least that's the mentality of some of the families. And I was seeing that coming together, and then there's the duration, end of life funds, but I'm just seeing a shyness. Unless someone can just, they're doing more due diligence on the funds. Definitely we're seeing, relationship building is important, domain alignment, values alignment, to Tammy's point. You got to find your some angles or edges in today's market. And definitely play, you know, even, I mean, Jonathan, you got a secondary from your original fund, right? That you got to find your ways to get access to liquidity for your LPs.
We do. We exited as much as we could in June of 2021 in IntroHive. And
I think it's you, Jonathan. You're a little.
Yeah, 500.
Is it me or Jonathan?
I think it's John.
All right. I'm going to have to stop his video.
Mark, if I can jump in with just one comment. I mean, our first fund is a smaller first fund now, you know, going into a second one. The problem, I mean, I'm looking at it, trying to understand the market for secondaries, but the problem is net asset value is still not enough, right? It's too soon, and I feel like the ones that are good are going to play themselves out. But at the same time, yes, more DPI would be tremendously helpful to everybody, including to the GP. So it's a catch 22, really.
But let me begs another point related question. What are people seeing in the IPO market?
We have one that is not in the fund, but in my personal portfolio that should list if they go through the process maybe next year.
But anyone active in the pre-IPO market? Anyone here?
Not as much.
I'm looking across.
Bill sent a message, maybe related to that. Bill Deutschler. Hmm.
Do we count SPACs?
Thanks, Rob. No, I just dropped something in the chat. Just in general, you know, dilution, company failure rate obviously has a huge impact on DPI. And it's a really difficult, I think the current environment is really tough on portfolio companies. And that makes it, you know, just all the more difficult. However, there have been a few funds that I've come across that have an actual process to try to do more effective portfolio management of their underlying companies. And that potentially has a huge impact on DPI. I mean, you know, just the simple math of it. If you can take your failure rate, you know, from 70-80%, you know, down to even like 60-50%, then, you know, just doing the math, your DPI can expand, you know, tremendously. But again, it's not an easy process, and I've only seen a few funds that have been able to implement that.
Hey, Bill, I think we should do a second half of the year survey. 20 should kick off. We have for July 20. If we could talk about that.
Sure. That sounds good.
I know you like sailing.
Absolutely.
Anyone else? Questions, comments on the theme? Dipinder, how do you see today's venture market as an active angel, value-adding active angel? You're on mute. Still on mute. One more still on mute. Dipinder, you owe us all a drink of whatever juice, you know, punch.
Okay. I think there are a lot of opportunities, and I think it's a good time to negotiate hard at what price point you go in with them. As always, the harder to raise money, the better the opportunities, in my opinion.
Fair enough. I might be driving by your truck stop in Pennsylvania. I'm going the way to Pittsburgh tomorrow.
Are you going on 80?
I might have to go. I usually go, what is it, 76? But I have to go more north to Pittsburgh.
Well, make sure you don't run out of fuel at our truck stop, because we're the most expensive gas in Pennsylvania.
Yes, of course. Anyone else? Well, maybe that's the sign. The pause is a sign sometimes. I will.
When are you back, Mark, from Pittsburgh?
The 8th.
Okay, got it. Let's get together.
By the way, Mark, for everybody,
are you there as well on the 21st?
Yeah, I'll be there.
Are you there for Monday or Tuesday?
I'll be there Monday, not. I don't think Tuesday, but I'm definitely there through the. We arrive. Okay. We're there at 10, and then we have the 11 a.m. start like last year. Well, we start a little bit earlier. We want more content this year. Breakouts. It'll look like this at the end. We should have taken the picture before everybody left.
Mark, let me know if you need a ride up.
As much as I love you, I'm going to drive myself.
And Mark, you missed Canoe Brook in Summit. That was really good. We're going to have another gathering in probably the next couple months.
I know.
So sorry we couldn't work with your timing.
I had to pick up my daughter at school, and that didn't work with your tea time. But
okay.
I think it is time for us to have a best ball tournament for 361. I don't know if we can do 18 holes, but I think we can get a 9-hole best ball afternoon in. So I'll be back on that one.
We have a 9-hole course.
That'll be the first, right?
Sorry, Jonathan.
We have a 9-hole course reserved on October 13th at Lansdowne right before our event, if you'd like to play that.
It could be. And by the way, Rob, do you know where Jonathan is, his county?
I was following this a little bit. I think it sounds like Northern Virginia. So I'm in Virginia part of the time. So look forward to hearing more, Jonathan.
Great. We'll connect, Rob. Thank you, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
But, Mark, this would be the first golf tournament by you?
We had golf and a shoot and like a range, but we'd be the first. We almost did one with Stephen Burke. But, yeah, it'd be the first. Official.
Okay. Take a look at your email. I might have something for you next week in the Tri-State area. So, okay.
Okay. Good to know.
Hey Mark,
that's a first to get an invitation from Rob Colorina a week in advance. That is a first. Sorry.
Hey Mark, is the meeting next week, is it in person in New York or is it virtual?
Which meeting?
This one.
Oh. Well, it's always virtual. The question is, do we do a Tuesday the 8th in New York because you happen to be in town?
I happen to be in town most of next week.
Are you here on the 10th?
I am here on the 10th until about 4 p.m.
We are trying to figure that out because now we have summer schedule in New York and the Hamptons and all that. So we are testing the waters to see if we do this, our meetup in person on the Tuesday or the Thursday. So I will, your right. vote, you sound like you're neutral.
I'm good either way. It's just, yeah, it I got a ton of meetings, but it's always good to meet up with more friendlies while I'm there.
Fair enough. Anyone else before we break? Again, join us in Newport. Ask tomorrow at 10:30. We talk about a tax update with the new legislation. That's more of a mobilization call of trying to get a really good roundtable panel for the next deep dive next week. Otherwise, we're planning out Hamptons. We're planning out London. And I don't know if Parth is still on. We're planning out Mumbai, Singapore, Riyadh, and then two big New York events. So if anybody, tomorrow at 10:30, we'll gather mainly about tax, but we'll talk about events in case anyone's around. Africa is 2026, at least two or three countries. We also have a LATAM event in Miami on September 12th. I don't know if Adam's on, but that's coming together. We got to get to Chicago. As much as I'm in Ohio, we got to do another Ohio event. So, and anybody wants to host a launch in your city, if you can do a Zoom, we're going to do one in Seattle, a Seattle breakfast, lunch New York. We're going to bring those two cities together. Also open to doing that.
Yeah, I'm open to doing something in Chicago. We've got some folks there.
We do it anywhere. Winston and Strawn loves us. We love Winston. We could do it from their offices or yours, for that matter.
Hey, we're in a big manufacturing hub. We could be right next to the machinery.
By the way, I visited with Rafiq at the M Hub. It's a great place to visit if we have a chance.
What's it called again?
M Hub.
Manufacturing hub. Yeah. It's this great ex Google prototyping facility that was left behind. So. Nice. It's where a lot of the local startups start. We're one of the few VCs here. Good ecosystem.
Great.
Great place for events. So if you're coming to Chicago, Mark, we do something. We gotta definitely get these guys involved too.
Mark, I threw a little note in there. Maybe first-ish week of October, St. Louis would be a good one. There's actually two things.
Tell me where it would be a bad place to be on the first week of October. Isn't that like the best week everywhere?
It'll be nice. It'll be nice. It's like October 6th. Figure like October 6th through the 9th. We can have a longer conversation.
October 6th is – there's a Seattle event. Not that I have to – I could go anywhere. Last time I was in St. Louis, the American Idol was there in my hotel. That was a while ago.
It's been a while. Now we got
I flew over it and it was flooded in 2008.
Yep. Now we're going to be throwing an event regardless, part of that week in conjunction with the National Defense Transportation Association. So they have a huge conference.
I have a call later today with a family office who has close ties to DOD and DOT. That's
cool. We'd love to talk to him.
Like, this is being recorded. This will be, you haven't seen it yet, but this will be transcribed and put into our AI. And if someone wants to know JP, you can see JP and all of his insights. If you want an insight on St. Louis, you look to the St. Louis. We're about to go from the outhouse to the White House. On AI.
Really, that's where we are.
the White House or the outhouse?
We're already dealing with the White House. There's a lot going on here that most people don't know about. And we're one of the only players in town.
Rafiq was talking about the Midwest advantage or arbitrage. There's certainly a St. Louis component of that.
Yeah, we've got a lot going on. You know, our thesis is squarely aligned with a massive amount of resources here. But again, we're global in nature, but we've got a lot of resources here that back up
good.
Thesis in a very strong way.
A lot of great people on this call that didn't speak. Goodbye, everybody. We'll have to connect soon. And we'll do a Tuesday, Thursday if you're in New York next week. We'll make that call in the next day or so. Let you know. And
have a good one.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Mark.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Appreciate it.